I sense her touch. She's warm and being light.
Well, welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. Show number one, underway. Can you believe that? We're going to have a lot to talk about, and that was a little bit of music from an album that I did back in 1987. I played that all over Europe. It's called The Fellowship. And what we're going to do starting today, I guess, is fellowship. And I think you'll like some of the music that you'll hear off and on throughout the show. But welcome to my show. And I hope to have a lot of interaction. We're going to cover a lot of interesting things. A lot of interesting things over the coming months. The first hour or two, I just sort of want to introduce myself, not to honk my own horn about what I've done, but I've done so many shows around the world, and people always get my background wrong and make things up that never happened and leave things out that did, so that it's confusing for a lot of people. So what I'm trying to do is set the record straight out of my mouth and not someone else's. It sure is a beautiful day here in Laguna Beach. We're broadcasting this from the top of a mountain, looking out over the ocean. It's pretty nice. Unfortunately, it's pretty polluted out there. It never used to be. Anyhow, my beginnings, humbly beginnings, started back about, during World War II, if you can imagine that. And I just can't believe all the decades I've watched go by. And so I'm going to share some of them with you, step by step by step. We'll have websites to look at and phone numbers to call, books to talk about. A lot of different things will be happening over the period of these shows. We're going to be sharing a lot of things with you that are very important, I feel. And if you don't, well, send me emails or whatever. And I guess existence, as far as I remember, started about 60 years ago in this world. It was a warm August day when all of this began. And it was kind of, I was having a few things go on just before I stepped into this world. I remember just a few things that happened briefly before I took my breath here. So let us begin. Well, I believe my memories started just a little bit before I was born. I was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan, back during World War II. And I do remember, it was interesting, just before I woke up in the University of Michigan hospital, I saw, remember talking to a woman in a spaceship, believe it or not. It was like a dream almost now. And later on, I was able to reflect when I was in kindergarten, actually nursery school, and 4 years old, on my past life in the Third Reich, which I'll get into in a few minutes. But having just left that life, moving into this one, it was kind of an experience. And I remember saying goodbye, and I remember waking up in my body and saying to myself, oh, darn it, you know, I can't move my arms, my legs, I'm going to have a language problem, I know all this. And I just remember that so well. And then I looked up, and when I looked up, I saw four people looking down at me, which was kind of interesting, and they all had these green outfit on. And I described these in later years to my mother, and she said these were Henry Ford's personal physicians. Norman Miller, I guess, was quite a guy at the time. In those days, physicians were rock stars. And my dad worked for Henry Ford Sr., and so because my dad was in his favor somewhat, he lended his personal physicians to the hospital to deliver me and bring me into this world. So it was kind of interesting. My mother could never understand how I remembered that, but that's what happens when you got a memory like mine. It just doesn't go away. Sometimes I think it's a curse, and sometimes I think it's a gift, depending on the mood I'm in. So anyway, that was the beginning of my life on this planet, my sojourn here, as you might say. Anyway, as life progressed, living in Ann Arbor, Michigan was kind of interesting. Later on, it became a blessing in disguise because I was able to have full access to facilities at the University of Michigan, where I spent a huge amount of my time.
I remember in nursery school, we used to lay on these little green cots, army cots, and I would flash on my, at that time I didn't quite understand what it was, but now I understand it better. It was my past life in the Third Reich, and I, in that time, was an archaeologist working for Hitler, and actually Himmler was my boss, and under him was a guy named Reinhard Heydrich, who I did not like at all, and some of the things they had me do was explore the metaphysical side of life, even though I was actually an authenticator. When Hitler, for example, raided the Louvre, they took over 4,000 paintings from the Louvre and brought them up to Berchtesgaden, where Hitler's compound was, which is in the south of Germany in the Bavarian Alps. Very beautiful place. And I was not a Hitler fan, just so you understand that. It was just where I was at the time, and I had to deal with it, and I dealt with it at the time. And I remember looking over these 4,000 paintings that he'd stolen from the Louvre and finding out about a third of them were fakes. And so it was really interesting. He gave them to the Reich Air Marshal, Hermann Göring, who had a place right down the road from Hitler's place, about a mile away. And it was interesting, at the end of World War II, they'd had a falling out, and Hitler was up in the Führerbunker up in Berlin, burning himself up and cyaniding himself with his family. And Göring was making a run from Switzerland. He got caught by the conquering generals at the time, and on his private train headed out for Switzerland. And on the train were all these fake paintings that he thought were real. So I guess Hitler had the last laugh, because they didn't seem to get along too well at the end. The other thing that was really interesting is that in this lifetime, I started working with a lot of the people that worked in the Third Reich. At the end of World War II, a lot of people are not aware of the fact that we had a thing called Operation Paperclip, where all the top generals and scientists of the Third Reich that were deemed non-harmful or they were humanitarian types, they brought them over here and put them to different positions in our science and society. And I had the honor of working with about four of them. So it was kind of interesting, me being born in an American, but with a memory of the Third Reich, working with a general or a scientist like Wernher von Braun, who I worked with, and having conversations with them and not really letting them know that I knew as much as they probably did on some of this stuff, and just kind of seemingly well informed on our conversations, which kind of amused them somewhat. At the University of Michigan, the first guy I worked with was a guy named Dr. Katz. And it was really funny, because a few years ago, back in the mid-90s, I was up at a place called the Bodhi Tree giving a seminar, and he had just been there. And he was like almost 100 years old, but he still was quite functional. So when I heard that he had been there recently, I thought it was quite karmic, to say the least. Anyway, getting back to the University of Michigan, I started there. I was actually attending Tappan Junior High School. I was in the 8th grade. And at night, I was fortunate enough to go over there at night and spend a lot of time in the night sessions that they were having with the different professors and the different students. And I started at the very beginning studying thermonuclear fusion and the effects of what's called the pinch effect and the effects of the bomb, the shock waves that a huge amount of heat and electromagnetic pulse produces when a bomb goes off, whether it be in the air, whether it be on the ground, or somewhere in between, or even underground. So those were the kinds of studies I was doing. And I also was learning about the effects of radiation on people, because back during the Manhattan Project, which is in the earlier 40s, when they were working on the development of the thermonuclear device, probably the atomic bomb that being the main thing, they had a lot of mishandling of nuclear radiation and radioactive substances, thorium, plutonium. So a lot of people died of cancer rather quickly, or other very sad causes that radiation, large exposure amounts, presents to the body. And one of the things that was really interesting was a study that was going on then. And they were studying the effects of the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And what they found was that there were certain people that were exposed to radiation at a very close, almost ground zero level in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that had very little genetic damage and overall serious damage from radiation and radiation poisoning. And then there were people farther away that had serious damage more so than the people up close. And they're wondering, well, how come people far away have a serious problem with radiation when some people, not all, didn't have much of a problem at all with radiation up close to ground zero? So we began to do studies on that, and we found out that the people that were not harmed by radiation had large amounts of electrolytes in their bodies. And electrolytes primarily reside in the brain, and they act very much like the electrolytes do in a car battery, for example. Electrolytes are chemicals that, when stimulated, ionize amongst themselves, producing electrical charges. In the case of the human brain, this ionization is produced when the synapses fire during the thinking process, which then sends electrical signals down through the spinal cord and other parts of the body. And any time electricity moves through anything, whether it be a wire or a nerve or an axon, it produces an electromagnetic field at a perpendicular angle, which then causes somewhat of a protective field to be around, whether it be a wire or a human being. In the case of a human being, the protective field will absorb the radioactive ionizing radiation and actually curve it and bend it into an electromagnetic radiation that the body can absorb without producing free radicals. Free radicals are what are produced in the body from radiation and other forms of poisoning, which then cause things to happen in our body, which can then cause cancer and other, infectious and not very nice diseases, which we'll get into a lot of this later on in the up-and-coming shows. But the first show or two that I'm going to do here on this network will be just about my background so that you can understand. Because I'm sure a lot of you out there have had strange backgrounds like I am. Not probably all of you, but I'm sure there's plenty of you. And if you hear one more insane person on a microphone, it might ring true to you and might help you in your daily cause, too, to make life a little bit better. That's hopefully what we'll accomplish here. So when we did these studies, we found out that there were large amounts of foci, ginseng, and gota cola in the diets of these Japanese persons that were not having a problem with radiation. So in later years, what I was able to do myself is plate trace minerals and mineral formulations, because I saw a huge deficiency in this country of nutritional things that were very, very important for the human body. And trace minerals, your body is, in case you don't know it, your body is 5% mineral, which controls 95% of your metabolic functions. And unfortunately, what happens now is that in our diets today, we don't have the trace minerals. So if we don't have the trace minerals, what happens is we're going to have some deficiencies in our personality, and we're going to have some deficiencies in our consciousness, which is exactly what we're experiencing planetary-wide right now. Anyhow, more on that later. So my mother was going through a divorce, and my father were married twice, if you can believe that. That this strangeness number one for Dr. Fred, born on second marriage to same parents. So parents divorced and remarried, and then I came along. So I guess I was an after effect or whatever you might say. Well, because of the strangeness that was going on with my father and mother, I was living a lot in Buffalo, New York, with my grandparents. And in my grandparents living there, I had in my own room, and it was a very quiet, beautiful place in Buffalo on Claremont Avenue. And I began to have astral experiences, and I began to have my first interface with extraterrestrials, in this case, people from Theta Reticuli, or I should say beings, from Theta Reticuli 3. And I had a encounter when I was very young. I was very much afraid of this encounter, but somehow or other I wasn't, with an extraterrestrial gray by the name of Gokti Lokti. If you can remember that name, Gokti Lokti. And as best I would know, it would be spelled G-A-L-K, possibly an E, and then dash, or hyphen, T-E, dash, L-O-C-K-T-E-T-I, Gokti Lokti. And what I learned from him at that time, I realize I'm still evaluating my past life experiences, and I'm kind of, it's like on a crash program to what I don't know at this point. And so he taught me the language, their guttural language. And the grays are, anatomical process is a little bit different than ours. They don't really have a digestive system as we do. That's kind of been gone by the wayside because of, I guess, bad food habits. too many meat eaters out there in the grays, who knows? And they absorb the nutrients from their skin. But anyway, what Gaufti Lofti taught me was their language. And if you were to wonder what the language sounds like, it would be, instead of we normally breathe out when we talk from the diaphragm, try talking and breathing in. And you'll start squawking and squeaking, and you'll make all these strange sounds, something between a choking horse and a cricket, and that's sort of the sound that the grays produce. It's a very high-pitched sound, and that's what they actually verbally communicate with, although most of the time it's a combination of that and telepathy. And what I think it does is it amplifies the telepathic aspect of the body, these high-frequency squawks that they make, because that does those kinds of sounds do stimulate the metabolism about anything that comes in contact with it, and it does produce a presentable result. So other things that I was working at the University of Michigan, we're working in a building that's been since torn down, and it was about six stories underground. And it was called the Randolph Lab. I'm sure some of you out there that will listen to my voice will know, remember the Randolph Lab at the University of Michigan. And that's where I worked most of the time, except when I was in the classrooms in the different engineering buildings, which was at night. But on weekends, I was usually at Randolph Labs. We had a Bevatron, we had a Synchrotron, and we had a Cyclotron there. These are devices for accelerating heavy particles and producing an ionization or radiation process, often common known as atom smashing. So I was working with atom smashers. And we were smashing atoms, and that was kind of interesting at the time. And then we used to have things called Wilson cloud chambers. Kind of an archaic thing from what they have today, but Wilson cloud chambers actually recorded antiparticles during the emissions and collisions of these different heavy matter particles like deuterons that we would accelerate in a cyclotron. And it was interesting, we had these huge power supplies that went primarily with the synchrotron that we used to use for something else. I remember going up and down the stairs in the Randolph Lab as a kid and noticing these huge banks of capacitors. And they weren't in a particular room. They were along the stairs, and you dare not fall on them. But because a pyranol capacitor would probably look like about four automobile batteries stacked, one on top of the other, with two big electrodes at the top being a plus and a minus. And they hold huge amounts of electricity. And imagine thousands of these things up on the stairs, all wired together. And what they were doing was charging huge amounts of energy measured in what's called joules. And not like jewelry, but joules, spelled J-O-U-L-E-S. And they would release at one point in time this huge amount of stored electricity into these huge coils in these underground chambers. And this was some kind of an attempt, I guess, to look at teleportation and time travel and all the other kinds of things that these huge electromagnetic fields that they produced. Later on, I was told that this was part of an experiment that, as it got out into the metaphysical world, was called the Philadelphia Experiment. And this was kind of the studies that were done in my time, which is in the early to mid-50s. These were follow-ons of the experiments that happened to the USS Eldridge in an earlier time at the different shipyards on the East Coast where it moved around. And the Philadelphia experiment, of course, probably most of you know because I explained this in my lectures around the world, started back during World War II with minesweepers coming up to Norfolk, Virginia to get demagnetized or degaussed. Because what happens when you move a piece of metal in a magnetic field, it has a tendency to become magnetized. And if it's a minesweeper, which is primarily a non-metallic craft, and it starts to get magnetized, that's going to set off mines. It's not going to detect and find them and remove them. It's actually going to set them off. So they have to come up for degaussing. And what would happen is that when these ships would go through the area south of Florida or southeast of Florida, known as the Bermuda Triangle, they would become invisible to each other on the radar, even though they were in plain sight. Now, that was posing an interesting question. Why would these boats that definitely occupy space and time and had this early warning radar stuff to keep a distance and a spacing between them and to monitor themselves, especially at night so they didn't have a collision, because it takes a lot to stop a big boat if it starts to collide with another boat. You just can't stop it like a car. They don't have brakes. They have many tons of mass moving. It takes a while to remove it just to bring it to Newton's second law of motion. So anyway, all of a sudden they'd be in the Bermuda Triangle, and they would notice that the radar, there's a ship, I can see it, but it's not on the radar anymore. What happened here? And so that became the beginning of what we call stealth technology today, with the F-117s and the B-2 and all the other stuff. But in between, there was a lot of quirky things and crazy things that happened. And that was kind of the beginning, and that's what we have, the debunking process is what I was involved with in the University of Michigan as one of my projects. Well, being back there, I had a cohort in all of this. His name was Stephen Eberbaugh. His dad owned the Eberbaugh pharmacy chain on the East Coast. And Stephen and I were playing around with a lot of other stuff, just besides what was going on at the University of Michigan. Stephen and I were hooking up electrodes to our occipital and parietal lobes in our brain and stimulating with electricity. Now, today that's not a big deal, but I guess it was back in the 50s. Nobody had done that yet. And we had built ourselves an oscilloscope, and we were actually monitoring these brain patterns and combining that with hypnosis and deep sleep therapy. So this is the kind of stuff we were doing. Well, the government kind of found out about what we were doing, because obviously this was a pretty highly restricted area that I was working in anyway. And in those days, they were looking for kids that were a little bit different. Today, our scholastic systems are geared so that the corporations want the kids coming out of school. So they'll push everybody through to herd out the kids that they want. And of course, as a result of that kind of a consciousness, we end up with a lot of kids going through high school and grade school that can't read or write when they hit the streets, because they were pushed through along with the brighter ones that are the more astute ones that were able to do these things rather quickly. And the corporations, of course, funded these projects and schools, and of course they want to have the kids. So that's what happens. Our school system is a little corrupt, to say the least. In those days, it was about the end of World War II, and everybody was paranoid that Russia had the bomb and the Iron Curtain was there, and so they were looking for kids that might make a difference in the science community after they got out of school, and I happened to be one of those chosen. At some point in there, I don't know exactly when, I suppose I was given a secret clearance. It wasn't until a little bit later when I was down in Arkansas, because my mother had now long since divorced my father and married my stepfather, and moved to Arkansas. So right in the middle of all this crazy government stuff that I was doing at the University of Michigan, we decided to move in the 11th grade I was in down to Pleasant Plains, Arkansas, which didn't last very long. I think I finished three semesters or four semesters down there, and Uncle Sam came and took me away, and I was herded off to the Air Force. But before I could go to the Air Force, you had to be 17 years old, so there was a slight problem. I was only 16, and I had been out of the government graces for about a year while I lived in Arkansas, which didn't set too well, so they immediately took me down and billeted me in Little Rock, Arkansas, near an Army base down there that was involved with chemical weaponry and the manufacture of biologic warfare devices. So I got a little education in that at 16 years old. On my 17th birthday, I was on a bus on the way to Lackland Air Force Base in the beginning of my basic training, which I completed at the United States Armed Forces Institute at Keesler Air Force Base, and went on into service up at Point Arena, California, 776 Aero Squadron. And that's an interesting place to work. First of all, that was part of a series of early warning radar sites set around the continental United States. Above us were what were called BMU sites up in Greenland and places like that, which were very, very high power radars. And we worked with a radar set called an ANFPS-35, which itself had a 466-foot antenna, was 9 stories tall. And we had one installed at Point Arena, and we also had one back at Montauk in New York, Upper Long Island. And I'm sure a lot of you out there have heard the stories of Montauk and all the stuff that Preston Nichols and all these other people espoused have happened to them. But there is one thing that I did notice working with this particular radar, and that was that it had an operating frequency of the Klystron magnetron tubes, mostly Klystrons. This was magnetron, by the way, was an earlier magnetic radiation amplifying tube, and it was later on replaced by a Klystron, was a oscillating magnetic tube, which was a little higher power and more efficient. But what I'm trying to get to is it had an operating frequency, a local oscillator frequency, if you would call it that, of 375 to 2425 megahertz. And that particular frequency is measured, if you were to look at it in some kind of a linear form, you'd look at the length of the wave before it goes from positive to negative back to positive, and how much space does it travel in time and space across the moving air before it completes one cycle of it of itself, and it happens to be about 3 feet or 39 centimeters. Well, strangely enough, 3 feet or 39.9 centimeters is about the length of human DNA. So when you start putting million watts of local oscillator frequencies around human beings at a central frequency of their human DNA, you start having a lot of strange things happen. And I'll guarantee you, we had all kinds of strange things happen at Point Arena Air Force Station. But beyond that, another thing that I noticed was that we had an operating window of about 450 miles. It's been since declassified because the radar is now obsolete, but at that time it was highly classified. And we had another set called an ANFPS-26, which had a height capability of several miles also, so we could look how high some object could be, and we could see how far away it was. And the idea of this was if we saw something that we didn't understand, then we would scramble jets from nearby Hamilton Air Force Base, which was part of a Strategic Air Command, which I was serving in at that time, which was based at Beale Air Force Base in Northern California. So we would send out scrambled jets for things that we didn't know what they were. Well, there was an exception to the scrambling rule, and that was what we saw every night. What we saw every night on this radar was many, many, many objects coming from outer space with a descent speed of approximately 20,000 miles an hour, far beyond the capability of our jets, to an altitude of 5,000 to 7,000 to 10,000 feet, and then slowing down, making an extreme left-hand turn facing the west and going down towards Mexico at a lateral speed of about 5,000 miles an hour. And this is pretty much happening every night in those days, and this, of course, was been the early 60s, so I was pretty amazed by this. Matter of fact, not only was I amazed by this and intrigued by this, but I was annoyed by this because the people that actually officially made the observations of these 5,000 mile an hour lateral flying objects were called scope dopes, meaning that they looked at these big round screens you've all seen on these sci-fi movies with a big round screen and a beam that goes around and around and it hits something and it lights up. It kind of leaves a little residue thing that kind of fades away until it comes around and sweeps around and lights it up again. And that sweeping that you see on the screen is representing the direction that the antenna is looking at that given time and what the beam is hitting. And so the people that watched that were called scope dopes. And they had to fill out a form when they saw something different. And this form was called a DDS Form 332. If you want to look it up in the archives, the DDS Form 332. They filled these forms out every night with all these objects being described, but strangely enough, we did not scramble any jets at all for these because there's nothing we could do about it. We just watched them. We were the audience. And the thing that really disturbed me was the fact that these DDS Form 332s were not reported to anybody. They were basically shredded the next day. So in other words, this never really happened. And that's kind of how the Air Force went in those days. It just never really happened. The other thing that was very interesting about the ANFPS-35 radar was developed by Westinghouse and General Electric of Sylvania and a few of the folks over at Los Alamos. And the radar, even though we were installing it and working with it back in the 60s, was actually developed in the late 40s. The Alamogordo Valley is conveniently located between Albuquerque, New Mexico, and just north of Santa Fe, provides a perfect path to transmit and receive high-powered radio frequency signals without broadcasting the nearby universe. And so this is what the area that was chosen, and of course Los Alamos being up Santa Fe way, was chosen to develop these radars. And a lot of the more modern weather control equipment, which we'll talk about later on, was also developed there. And what happened is back in the 40s, late 40s, when this stuff was coming out around about 46, 47, when the transmitters were up and running, putting out about the high-powered sets that we were developing now were 5 to 10 million watts, mostly around 5 million watts. The stuff we had at Pearl Harbor was a few thousand watts back in the 1942, 1941, those times. So it really wasn't the radar, which was originally developed in England, the radar that they had then was nothing like what we were developing in the late 40s. Much, much more power. Thousands of times more powerful. And what was happening was we were being observed by a lot of different extraterrestrials, because this kind of energy does go out into space, and it is detectable, and it is kind of noticeable. It's about anyone that's around that has any kind of sensitivity. And so at the time, the Grays, were the Theta Reticuli people, were studying and hanging out a lot with these facilities and watching what we were doing. I don't know whether we'd made contact with it or not. I know we did in 51, but they were getting in front of these beams. And what happened was that we found out later, the propulsion systems in their ships were plutonium, somewhat plutonium oriented, and when they would get in front of these beams, it would cause what's called a critical mass and a flash point inside their little ships. So when a nuclear reactor reaches critical mass, it puts a huge amount of heat out, and as a result, it kind of roasted the people inside of their ships. It was very uncomfortable. So the ship came down relatively intact, because they were brought down by an internal problem caused by these testing of these radar sets. And of course, when they crashed in Roswell, which is the one that set things off in our public society, it wasn't the first ship that fell on Matt Braswell's ranch. It was the second ship that they don't talk about. It was about 100 feet across and had a lot of human body parts that put the lid on the whole UFO thing back in then. You don't hear much about that. I really didn't know about it at that time either. I found out about it later on when I was working at Rockwell and NASA, because some of the people I worked with, their fathers had been out on the actual expedition at Roswell and had made the actual report. So I got direct family information on the authenticity of what these crashes were. And the Roswell wasn't the only one. There was one in Laredo. There was one in Aztec, New Mexico. They were in several different areas. So it wasn't just like this was the only one. So I spent a couple of years up at Point Arena and decided it was time to leave there. So I left the Air Force and came down to Southern California and went to work for Rockwell Corporation. And I'd been trained in instrumentation along with everything else in the Air Force, and I continued on with my training in instrumentation. And I also had a physics background by this time too, pretty strong physics. So I had an electronic and physics and somewhat of a mechanical engineering background this time, with some interesting studies and things that I'd done. So my instrumentation made me very valuable, because at this point in my life I was able to instrument or put quantitative and qualitative analysis programs to work for any project you might have. And so you could be IBM, you could be Rockwell, you could be anybody. In the case, my first series of assignments was Rockwell, because it was like a miniature group of many, many corporations. You know, there was the Autonetics Division, we had the Santa Susana Rocketdyne Division, we had all these things. We were developing guidance equipment. I worked on what was called a G10 gyro, which went into a Minuteman a rocket. I worked on other gyros and sevens that went into nuclear submarines. I remember the Thresher, when it went down, we had put the guidance system in that. I worked on the guidance systems that later on went into the Saturn. As a matter of fact, it was my work that got me down to Seal Beach and the NASA facilities because of that work that I did. I worked over at Autonetics on what was called the ILAS project. The ILAS project later on became, during Reagan's time, was known as Star Wars, where we were using neodymium and europium solid-state rare earth lasers, which back in the, now we're in the 60s, later 60s, people didn't even know what that stuff was in those days. The word laser, light amplification by stimulation emission of radiation, was unheard of in the general public. But yours truly was there with his sleeves rolled up, having a great old time. I worked all over Rockwell, and I got to know all the different kinds of instrumentation. My job was not only repairing, calibrating some of the equipment. So I had what's called a meteorology background, and I took always taking more classes. I was always taking a NASA class for soldering or inspections and learning how to do more and more, you know, delicate kind of instrumentation projects. So I was constantly working and studying in those days, and that was where a kind of interesting thing happened. That's where I sort of got into nutrition. I was young, but I was having tremendous leg cramps and problems. This cramping and pain in the leg, my legs, and I was only like 20 years old, 21 years old. My leg pains were so great that I had to wear these support stockings. And I guess I had some kind of a circulation problem. I even had a little bit of a varicose vein problem. So somebody suggested, I used to stop work. We were working in these big hangars on cement floors. And I had to stop and go in, and they would apply heat lamp treatments to my legs on a daily basis, which the company didn't really like doing, you know. And I didn't really like having it done, but it did relieve the pain, but it was stupid. So I ran into somebody, I forget who it was, I think it was a doctor at the time, and he says, why don't you try vitamin E? I says, okay, I'll try vitamin E. So I went down to the store, they didn't have health food stores, and then you just had to, I forget where I got the vitamin E, I found it somewhere. And started taking it, and within about 3 weeks, I know that my cramping in the legs stopped. It actually went away, and that was really neat. I no longer had cramping of the legs, and that was my sojourn into nutrition, which, of course, it went far beyond that afterwards, but that was where it was at the time, and it was really great. It was probably during this time that I somehow or other was beginning to get some kind of a subconscious telepathic impulse from the Pleiadians, because I began to think a lot about spaceships while I was working at Rockwell, especially when I got down to Seal Beach. And Seal Beach was it's on the California coast, and that's where we would take our part of the Saturn project and put it in a boat and ship it down to the Cape where it would be launched, and actually assembled and launched. And the two main areas that I worked on was the second stage of the Saturn rocket and the Apollo itself. I sat in every one of the every single Apollo module ever built. I actually sat in it and did some testing and things. I used to pretend I was an astronaut. I'd lay back in those seats and flip the switches on the ceiling. It was kind of neat. I guess a lot of people would like to do that, but I got to do it. So anyway, while we were down at Seal Beach, we had a lot of accidents happen because the programs did not go that smoothly. They actually went very, very badly. We had more problems than you might even know about. Everything, we used to have fires because things weren't wired right, so we'd put electricity to a circuit and it would burn up. And one time we were doing some pressure testing to simulate the fuel, and we were in one of the tanks, and the fuel tank broke, and about 500,000 gallons of water spilled all over the place and flooded the area. So, I mean, we had some interesting things happen. But I remember telling my cohorts at the time that we would have a flying saucer come and visit us the first time we took a Saturn out of the hangar. And the hangar was a big, tall building, looked like a skyscraper with the doors opening up on the side of it, and the entire side of the skyscraper opening up and the rocket coming out on a big track that was on. And that's exactly what happened. I forget what year it was, but it was probably around 65 or so. We opened the doors and brought the rocket out the first time we'd had one out at night, because most of us worked at night. And sure enough, 420 people witnessed the flying saucer hovering in Seal Beach right over the top of these brand new Saturn rockets that we were building, second stage, which I thought was kind of interesting. So that created a pathway of excitement. So anyway, I left Rockwell and went on into my own private endeavors. I worked out in the private sector for a long time because I found that I had a lot of skills that people wanted. And so I began to go to thousands of companies all around the country selling them instruments, because I became first a manufacturer's rep, and then I had my own company where I actually remanufactured test equipment, sold new test equipment, and put together testing systems, entire testing systems for people around the country. And so I got to visit IBM in New York and Bell Telephone at Murray Hill and all kinds of nice IBM and RCA plants down in Florida. And I used to go to the Atomic Energy Commission out in Amarillo, Texas, and sit on top of nuclear weapons underground and teach them how to monitor their weapons better, because all those warheads had to be kept alive and nursed. They had to be babysitted on a daily basis. So that kept me going for quite a number of years. It was interesting, too, because just before 9/11, I was working with Stephen Greer on the Disclosure Project. And we were trying to get, there's a lot of times the government almost released information of extraterrestrials to the public. The first time, I believe, was where it almost happened was in 1992, when the Ringham and Barnum and Bailey Circus people down in Florida were told that they could, from the Pentagon, receive a couple of fetuses or extraterrestrial type fetus arrangements in a solution in a jar, in a glass jar that could be observed and shown to the general public, some samples of a crashed spaceship and some very interesting videos. And so they spent about $10 million getting together a circus train to go around the country to do all of this. I remember, I think it was November of 92, and the 11th hour, when the Barnum and Bailey was all ready to go to town and start bringing the American public the awareness of extraterrestrials interfacing with us, the Pentagon at the 11th hour pulled the plug, and Barnum and Bailey was out about $10 million, and they weren't very happy. That was the beginning of what I believe to be the attempt to bring about some kind of public knowledge or confirmation of what was really going on. So anyway, I was involved with Stephen Greer, and he's a Beltway brat from Washington, D.C., and we had some pretty good ends over at the Senate, so I sent my records. I have records of all these companies. I visited over 3,000 companies over the years when I had my own company, working all these classified experiments anywhere. Sometimes I could be at the Lockheed Skunk Works. We'd be looking at putting strain gauges on a wing of some supersonic airplane that's going in a wind tunnel, or I could be, I remember doing some cryogenic work at a place up in Fullerton, Ogden Labs, just places all over that I went to. So I had all this, I have all these names and all these companies and all their projects all listed. I was smart enough to keep all the records. I still have them today in a vault. So I took copies of them to the Senate to put before a subcommittee so we could do some sort of work. They wanted some kind of credibility about my background. I thought that was plenty enough. And we were making progress towards maybe getting something pushed through where we could actually get the Freedom of Information Act redone a little bit and get some real freedom of information out there rather than a bunch of reports that you get now with everything X'd out that's interesting with somebody's marker pen. So you end up with a bunch of spots on a piece of paper that's supposedly classified, declassified information. Not. So anyway, we're right in the middle of this, and all of a sudden, guess what? 9/11 hit. So all of the stuff that we were working on became secondary information, and of course, the terrorist thing and all the things we're dealing with now came to light, so we now once again had the extraterrestrial situation put on a back shelf where it remains today, unfortunately. Today, but we are going to bring it forward anyway. We're not going to wait anymore for the government because they're going to drag their feet and create all kinds of side effect events to waylay the true information coming to the American public. And it was interesting because recently Brazil has decided the government down there to release this information. And about the best thing that they were able to release in their information to the world was the fact that the United States government is covering up and putting pressure on all the other governments to keep covered up the true situation. So that's what really came out. As far as information, statistical and factual information on events themselves, they didn't come out. Just the notice that, yeah, the U.S. doesn't want anything out. So now we know that. I guess that's new information, maybe. Who knows?
I turn around. I know that sound. It carries her name.
I just thought you might need to hear that right in the middle of all this, because that brings us up into the next phase of where we're going with all the things that we're talking about. That is a little bit further down into the fellowship, but that last sound you heard was a Pleiadian ship. They do exist, and that was a real one, actually dutifully recorded. And that brings me up to the point in this little sojourn into the hello land of all the people out there listening now, where we get into the phase of my extraterrestrial contacts and how they all started. Well, they were always on the back of my mind, I suppose. Really starting to kick in pretty much way before what we were just talking about, probably at the latter part of NASA. And when I sold my electronics company and let it go by the wayside, it was time now to do something different. So I took some time off and began to study with a different Himalayan master. I was pretty much fed up with the government lifestyle that I lived most of my life up to this point. I hadn't had much of a personal life, that's for sure. I looked more inside of laboratories than I did the sun, so I needed to have a big change in my life. And so that was the beginning of it. So I began to learn about meditation and studying and do all the kinds of things that we necessarily need to do. We don't take the time actually to do these kinds of things. So I began to do the meditation and the yoga and the breathing, and I became a vegetarian and studied with these Tibetan masters and for many years, and a whole change in consciousness came about. And I thought maybe I would never go back to the scientific world, what I'm back into again. But at that point, I had no more use for it in my life, I thought. So in the process of teaching Kundalini Yoga and learning Kundalini Yoga and all these different things, I began to learn that the human mind was very powerful. I learned things like energy follows thought, careful what you think. And I also learned that the mind is the slayer of the real. What your daily thoughts are typically aren't real. You're just coping with what your existence is at that point in time, and don't take it seriously. Those are the kinds of lessons I was learning. Well, in the process of going through that learning process, I began to get impressions in my mind of something else coming from somewhere else. Not like a madman experiencing voices after too much drink or drug, but something that was actually there that was a part of me, but it wasn't. And so I began to put meditation classes together so that I could teach of the possibility of an extraterrestrial contact and how that might be theoretically, because remember, the scientist part of me was still there, if it were to happen. Well, it did happen in 1971 in Laguna Beach, California, up on Nestal Road. Strangely enough, where several years previous to that, a guy by the name of George Adensky that also lived in that same street and had similar experiences. I had an experience at 3 o'clock in the morning when an extraterrestrial ship came down over my house on Nestal Road. And Nestal, Laguna Beach in those days was very sparsely populated, and we were on the edge of a cliff. And so I looked out over the cliff, and hovering behind the cliff was this big, huge spaceship with a squirrel in it. And I had my first encounter with a woman from the Pleiades known as Samyasi. And I don't know if it was the best encounter you could ask for, but it was definitely an encounter, because somehow or other I'd been thinking about her too much, and my meditation group had been thinking about the possibility of this contact a little too much, and it kind of prematurely brought them over to meet with us, and kind of their message was to slow down with what you're doing, and we'll come to you when the time is right. And I remember that the dogs, were 3 o'clock in the morning, and dogs were barking everywhere, even though there weren't that many houses. I don't know where the dogs came from, and she pointed, standing in her ship, hovering, telepathically talking to me, saying, "See how loud the dogs are? This is all wrong. We shouldn't be having this meeting at this time. You've kind of brought us on a little fast." And I guess being a triple Leo, I have a lot of mental energy that's out of control most of the time, and this being a case in point. So I dealt with it, and they left, and I scratched my head and wondered, well, this is very interesting. My life has definitely made a turn into the unknown now. And I do remember, of course, over time, how the contacts began was that, besides that one, I mean, it was kind of like I had this kind of a sensual feeling in my body, and then I would see the hair on my arms kind of raise, and then I would hear a separate voice, a soft voice in my head, and that was with Samyasi, because a lot of people ask me What was it like? How did you make contact? What is a telepathic contact? Well, to me, it was a feeling at first. And once that feeling was pretty much apparent and wasn't going to go away, regardless of the environment that I was in, and then I knew the voice would be following soon. And it took me a long time, to many, many years of that, to understand. Because somehow or other, my thoughts got interfered with the voice, even though she could say A, B, C, D, E, F, G. The voice might be in my head, A, G, Z, D, or something. There was a problem with my thinking, I guess, the way it worked, and my clarity. And I had a tendency to, what we would call my internal vocal discriminator, did not discriminate the proper words, vowels, and sounds to get the proper meaning of what was being transferred to me at the time. Later on, I got it down to a science, but it took almost 8 years. And out of the 20 years that we worked together, it was really amazing. The 8 years of it was, just me learning. It's like learning how to read and write and walk and talk all over again. It was a lot of work. It wasn't easy. So I began to learn how to do all of this stuff with her. And at that time, it was just a lot of fun. I also, during those times, began to realize it was time to go back to the work in the working world, and so I started my company called Pyridine, which exists today. And I'm sure you can see a website, which is pyridine.com, which will be on the computers that you'll probably be listening to this in the very beginning on. And if you want to reach me, I'm at 1-800-729-2603 at some point in time during these different tapes and recordings that I'll be doing. So anyway, Sannyasi and I began to meet at different places. Pyridine was young, and we were traveling around the country. I was working with the National Health Federation, which was a freedom organization designed to keep our constitutional freedoms as far as freedom of health choices in place. The National Health Federation, formed in the early 50s, had a forum of some of the top doctors at the time, and we went all around to 5 or 6 major cities, usually every other month, and we spoke to the general populace about things of nutrition, matters of nutrition and politics, and the things that we were all into at the time. So, matter of fact, it was the National Health Federation that got our vitamins legislated so that we could have freedom of choice with our vitamins. Otherwise, you'd be getting a prescription to go get a vitamin, and you would not get a natural vitamin. You would be getting a synthetic vitamin. And a synthetic vitamin, when put in the body, robs the body of its natural vitamin storage. So a synthetic vitamin is basically poison. That's the kind of stuff that you would have had it not been for the National Health Federation. When you walk into a store and you see vitamin D and vitamin A added and all these things in milk, for example, this is very bad. If you were to consume milk for calcium, for example, there's vitamin D added. Well, vitamin D normally comes to your body from sunlight. One square inch of your skin is 18 international units. But if you use calciferol as a synthetic form and put it in milk, what happens is it robs your body of vitamin D, and for a long period of time, your body can't assimilate calcium. Calcium is normally used by the heart in its largest amount once you stop growing. It doesn't go to the bones anymore in growth. It goes to the actual beating of the heart with an enzyme called actin that produces. And when actin is produced by calcium and vitamin D, then what happens is the heart beats. It produces an electrical signal. Just about everything you buy in a store is not good for you, as you probably know. Like, for example, tomatoes. Tomatoes are very good. Thing of any phytochemical that you put in your body from a natural plant is very anti-carcinogenic in its ways. But with tomatoes, if you can't smell them, they're dead. So I always get the ripened on the vine organic tomatoes. Those are pretty healthy. And so you pretty much end up in a health food store or a store that has organic produce and things to get good things to put in your body. Everything else is full of chemicals, and our whole society is obviously chemicaled out pretty good, as we're seeing pretty much on a daily basis. Well, anyway, I hope you're enjoying our show. And in the future, we're going to be getting into a lot of other subjects. I will be able to continue more of the background of my life so you understand it, because we're just getting into that now. We're going to be talking about a lot of different things. I wrote a book called Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light that you might be interested in. It sells at Amazon, and it also sells on the Paradigm website, and other bookstores have it. And it's about a 500 and some odd page book. It weighs, I think, 4.5 pounds. We call it the telephone book, and it has about 400 and some odd illustrations in it. So it covers a lot of things from anywhere from nutrition to energy to auric fields to all kinds of things in the scalar wave world that we work in. We get into propulsion systems, work that I did after NASA out there. I've done a lot of independent projects, still continue to do those even now. You'll be learning more about those. We're going to be trying to get our website updated more. And, of course, the blog and service website will carry some articles with different pictures which we'll be providing. This is all brand new right now, and we're just getting this thing started. So it takes time to really integrate all the necessary factions to make this a whole and complete series of programs that has some kind of a meaningful purpose in your daily life. In your daily understanding, but I hope to cover a lot. I've got a lot to say on terrorism and what's really going on, which I'll cover probably in the next show or the show after that. There's a lot of stuff out there that you guys need to know that you don't know right now. The things that are about to happen, for example, that aren't really that good. We're going to be talking about those kinds of things and how to prevent things to happen to you and how to have some kind of an ounce of prevention, which is worth more than a pound of cure. And I think you'll notice there's a lot of nuclear devices we sell, like radiation detectors, the keychain thing we sell on our website, those kinds of things. There's a reason why all that stuff is there. And if you read some of the articles on the website, you're going to find that a lot more information will be conveyed to you than is today. And like I also say, I recommend that you get a copy of the book or use one that somebody has so that you can be well informed when we get into the really high-tech stuff, which I know a lot of you out there want to hear. And I'm excited to do it, but I want to do this sequentially so that everybody understands it, not just the chosen few. So those are the kinds of things to look forward in the future. And, of course, to email us your questions. Customer service at paradigm.com is one place to send emails to. There's a friend of mine, his name is Mitch Matthews. He works for us. He's very informative on the work that I'm doing, too. So I guess it's time to say goodbye and hope you enjoyed the show today. I know I certainly made enough mistakes making it, so hopefully I'll get my recording techniques down better. And we'll have a better tomorrow. And thank you for listening.